Hello, Ramblers and Gamblers. Josh Rosenthal here. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling. Email ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Three interviews today. We're doing NFL Improvement Index with PFF's Kevin Cole, an RNG fave, making his triumphant return. Then we're doing a Masters gambling preview with Cam Rogers, who hosts Lock It In on the Believe Network. Then, last but not least, this is an interesting one. We're talking about why California could be the holy grail of sports gambling. Politico's Jeremy B. White is breaking that one down. Should be a good one. Here we go. First up, my friend and yours, Kevin Cole. Kev, welcome back to the RNG pod. Good news, unlike the last time we did this, I'm not stranded in Bemidji, Minnesota. The weather did not prevent me from getting back to DC. I also, sadly, on this note, no longer have my father-in-law's 9-pound walleye mounted on the wall behind me. So we're off to a good start.
Yeah. Well, that was good, though. It was kind of getting in touch with, you know, flyover country, maybe.
I believe you.
A little rustic abode, you know. It was good.
I was just gonna say, you described my in-laws' decor as rustic, and I think that description was apt. Anyway, back to business. Over at Pro Football Focus, you guys have what's called the Improvement Index. This is really cool. Basically, it's a way to quantify the value gained and lost by each team during the offseason. Without getting too highbrow here, keep it simple for me, for the non-data scientists among us. How does the Improvement Index work? What do you factor in?
Sure. It's really looking at the difference between one snapshot of what we're projecting for what will happen in 2022 versus another snapshot. And the first snapshot, kind of the baseline, if you will, for the projection is looking at the rosters for all 32 teams at the end of last season, the players that were on those teams, taking a snapshot of what we project will happen in 2022. So this is not looking at their improvement over what actually did happen in 2021. It's looking at what those rosters we're projecting would do in 2022. And then every single time there's a change to the roster, I go and I reproject how the snaps will split out, how efficient those players will be, what it means for their win total for 2022, and then look at the percentage difference in what those wins will be. And that's how the index is formulated.
Top five most improved teams as of April 3rd. Denver, number one, followed in order by the Colts, Raiders, Browns, and Dolphins. First, why is Denver number one? Obviously, they landed Russell Wilson, but there were some other big quarterback moves this offseason, too.
Yeah. I mean, Russell Wilson's a big one. I think the other biggest quarterback move from a pure, you know, effect on win probability was probably Deshaun Watson, but I'm building into the formula the fact that he's likely to miss at least some time, I believe, this season. So maybe that's why there's a bit of a disconnect between Watson's impact and the impact of Wilson. The other factor is here, again, there is a comparison to what was there before. So if you have someone like Drew Locke, who hasn't been very successful so far in his career, there, you know, Teddy Bridgewater is moving on. There may be a little bit lower baseline for what the production they were going to get out of the position. So it is mostly Russell Wilson factor here, but they also brought in Randy Gregory, who I'm assuming is going to be able to up his snap count. He's only been maybe like a 40% player in the past. I think he can up that a bit this season. They brought in DJ Jones on the interior defensive line. So he's going to give a good contribution there. And if you look at, you know, who they lost this offseason, it wasn't a ton because it's already calculating in the fact that someone like Von Miller wasn't going to be there. So some of their biggest players that they lost, you know, they lost Shelby Harris as part of the trade. They lost Noah Fant as part of the trade. But those are kind of minor differences compared to what we're seeing, what they added primarily with Russell Wilson.
As a Washington Commanders fan, a long-suffering one at that, it concerns me that you have the Colts at two. After they traded their quarterback to us, is this ranking because Wentz is bad, Matt Ryan is good, a little bit of both?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I mean, they also did trade for Yannick Ngakoue. So they have him coming in there, and he's going to make a difference for them. That's their other big move. I think what's important to realize for, like, as you mentioned, I guess maybe not long-suffering Commanders, since Commanders is a little bit of a new nomenclature there, but for long-suffering fans of the Washington football team in this area here, is that this is just a projection for one season. So the biggest differentiator probably between the value of someone like Matt Ryan versus the value of someone like Carson Wentz is the fact that Wentz is quite a bit younger, has a longer runway of prime play, whereas Matt Ryan could be trailing off. So I think that's it. That there's really probably more of a floor here for Matt Ryan that isn't really part of the calculation. It's really looking more at like the median type income for Matt, outcome for Matt Ryan. And Ryan has been, according to our grading, a better, more consistent quarterback over the last few seasons. So that's why for at least 1 year, even though we're getting into his late 30s here, for at least 1 year, he does project to be a better quarterback.
That makes sense. Any other takeaways you want to hit on from teams that have improved so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two different categories here. As we kind of mentioned when we're talking about Russell Wilson, is the quarterback is a huge driver here. We had the Broncos at number one, the Colts at number two, the Browns at number four here. So those are driving a lot of those improvements. I think for the rest, what's really interesting to me is that there's huge, huge investments for the Raiders and the Dolphins that are up there, primarily in not only what they are now going to be paying Devontae Adams and paying Tyreek Hill, but for the fact that they had to trade away assets as part of that. So I guess that's something to think about in that. And then if you look at the next team, I think the Chargers are just a really interesting team because they have the hopefully elite quarterback play already in mind. They didn't have to trade away anyone to make some additions that they did. So by getting that, entering into Justin Herbert's third year, in a lot of ways, I feel like they could be the most successful franchise for this offseason because they're tied with someone with like the Jaguars for their improvement. Now, the Jaguars are on a little bit of a discount because it's their percentage improvement, so they're coming off of a lower number there. So they actually have a real better improvement than the Jaguars, despite the fact the Jaguars spent a lot more money on some of these different signings.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that even though the Jags signed a lot of people, you're probably not crazy about who they signed or what they paid for them.
Yeah, I'm not really. What it seemed to be, and, you know, there's probably some stuff behind the scenes about the difficulty in attracting free agents to play for the Jacksonville Jaguars. Maybe they have to pay up a little bit more for that. But I would have liked to have seen them be a little bit more patient. I think the Christian Kirk deal at $18 million a year became somewhat emblematic of not only that signing in itself, but the other signings that they made, which was going out there early, identifying players who they wanted, basically being willing to cut a check for whatever it was going to take to bring them in. And if they could have been a little bit more patient, maybe you could have found more value as time, you know, passed during free agency. And there's probably also something there where I think a lot of different teams, you have to worry sometimes about the job security aspect of the front office. And with Trent Baalke there, if they don't make a jump this season and this season only, if they continue to struggle this season, he's probably out of a job. So sometimes in those circumstances, there can be some overpays in free agency, especially early in the process.
Here's the bottom five, the teams that have gotten worse this offseason. Dead last, you've got Seattle, followed by the Falcons, Chiefs, Bears, and the Patriots. With the Chiefs all the way down there, is that mostly losing Tyreek Hill?
Yeah, it's mostly losing Tyreek Hill. I mean, Tyreek Hill and wide receivers generally are some of the most important players according to our wins above replacement calculation, which drives our estimates for how many wins a team is going to have next season. So Hill is one of the most important players. He's been at a very high level for a while. He's 28 years old, so we don't see him, again, dropping off next season at least. Maybe, you know, a few seasons into the future, he could drop off a little bit in his late 20s. So he's the big factor there. But there is more than just Hill. If we go through this, you know, they lost Tre'Davious Ward, who is a cornerback. Again, coverage players are pretty important by our standards. They lost him to the 49ers. Tyrann Mathieu was just assumed that, you know, he's not going to sign back there most likely. So he's another player who's been very, very important for him and one of the most productive safeties actually, I believe the most productive safety according to our WAR calculation over the last several seasons. You know, he's a first team All-Pro in 2020. He was second team All-Pro in 2019. He's been a pretty good player there for them. And then they had some other, you know, minor losses that they had that weren't quite recouped by the fact that they brought in guys like Juju Smith-Schuster and Marquez Valdes-Scantling, but those guys just don't make up for what you're going to get on a snap-by-snap basis from someone like Tyreek Hill.
How the Patriots end up down there?
Yeah, the Patriots are an interesting one. I was looking at that, too, to try to figure it out. I mean, if you remember, the Patriots were at the top, I believe, of the calculation by improvement index last season, despite the fact that I don't think they had necessarily a great free agency period. I mean, the Matthew Judon signing that they had worked out pretty well, Hunter Henry pretty well, but then they also spent a ton of money on, you know, Nelson Aguilar and maybe some Kendrick Bourne type of receivers, and then Jonnu Smith, who didn't work out so well. So when we flip forward to this season, one of the biggest signings, again, coverage players are big for us and cornerbacks are big for us. So the biggest cornerback on the free agent market was J.C. Jackson. So he left the Patriots to go to the Chargers, so who I mentioned before, I think had a good offseason. So that was a big signing there. They also lost Shaq Mason in a trade, which was a little bit of a curious trade. Maybe they just didn't want to pay the $9 million APY that he had, that he was been making a year for there, but they traded him away to the Buccaneers, and they also lost another guard in Ted Karras to the Bengals. So it's the combination of those. Now, the Patriots have been very good over the last several years of being able to substitute guys in and out on that offensive line and still have an outstanding unit. So it could be that the formula is overestimating what the loss will be for losing a couple of top-notch guard players there, but it's still part of our formula.
Any other good tidbits, anything else that sticks out to you with the teams that got worse or have gotten worse thus far this offseason?
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhat as the flip side of the equation for the quarterbacks who have been lost there. But what I think is really interesting is that the whole phenomenon that maybe gets overplayed a bit because people like to say generally antagonistic type of things on social media, but, you know, the cap's not real. Teams don't have to worry about these things. They can always rejigger and figure things out. Again, when you have teams like the Chiefs, the Saints, the Green Bay Packers, the Dallas Cowboys, the LA Rams, all these teams are down in the negative for what they've done so far this season. And it's not that they can't retain anyone, or it's not that they never bring anyone on board, but it's just generally they don't have the cap flexibility perhaps to sign the players who they would like to, and they don't have the cap flexibility to keep certain players. And certainly, I don't know if Tyreek Hill would have been traded if not for some issues in the coming years for the players who they brought in on the Chiefs and their cap numbers going up. So I think the cap is, you can manipulate contracts more than the cap. The cap is very, very real. Contracts may be a little bit fake, but when teams really start to lean in to maximizing that cap space every year, eventually there becomes an offseason where you get a little bit worse, and we've seen that for those teams this offseason.
How much do you expect these rankings to change after the draft?
I mean, I think they're going to change quite a bit, if only for the fact that there's a concentration of draft picks in few hands at this point. I mean, it's been played around a little bit now when we had, I know we'll talk about the Eagles and the Saints trade, but we have a lot of teams. We have the Jets. We had the Eagles with three first round picks. Now we have they have two now, and then the Saints have a couple of first round picks. We have, you know, the Seahawks gaining some picks as part of these trades. So this offseason and next offseason, again, you know, the Chiefs picking up an extra pick, the Packers picking up an extra pick. These two offseasons, more than any that I can remember in recent memory, as a consequence of the fact that teams are more willing to trade away their picks, maybe to replicate what the Rams had done in their success, because of that, we're seeing more concentration of draft capital within a handful of teams. So that's going to have an outsized effect on how this will change during draft season, rather than kind of evening out the effect when everyone has their first round or second round pick.
We might as well pick that one up now, because I did think this was interesting. Specifically, I thought your comments on this Eagles-Saints trade was interesting. Just so everybody's caught up, Monday, Eagles traded two 2022 first-rounders, so for this upcoming draft, the 16th and 19th picks, as well as a 22 sixth-rounder. Then they got back from the Saints the 18th pick in this coming draft. So basically they just moved down a couple spots for this draft. 2023 first, 2024 second, plus a 2022 third and seventh. Now, Kevin, that's a mouthful, certainly, but I think what's interesting here, 2 points you made. Number one, that future picks tend to be undervalued, and number two, that for the Eagles, this could be a hedge on Jalen Hurts. Could you elaborate on that one for me?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the valuation of future picks is always difficult because there's a couple of different ways to do it. I mean, if you don't want to have any sort of discount for future picks, I think that is, you know, it's just not realistic. It's not what the market views them, how it views them, how it's been traded before. But how the market has generally valued future picks would be to move them down by maybe a round. So let's say a first round pick in the future is worth a mid to early second round pick this season and so on. So, but I think you have to assume that at least the discount that we've calculated and applied to it matches this too. But there's also an assumption that, you know, GMs, as I mentioned earlier, they're concerned about their job security. They're maybe impatient, ownership's impatient, fan bases are impatient. So they're probably going to overpay to get that, you know, bird in the hand right now rather than wait for a year from now what they're going to end up doing. So that's really the causation for why the future picks are undervalued. And I think from the Eagles' perspective, and this is, again, what we can mention here, is they had three first-round picks. There can be issues, number one, with, you know, bringing on maybe too much talent to potentially develop. And then number two, they have Jalen Hurts, who has been a massive hit from the perspective of him being a mid to late second round pick from where he's going for. I mean, he's barely making any money. When we talk about these quarterbacks making, you know, $50 million a year right now, he's making a few million dollars a year. So that's a huge, huge hit for them. But his status as a locked in starter for the next 5 to 6 years is questionable at this point. And in the same vein as making the Jalen Hurts pick in the first place, shortly after extending Carson Wentz, the Eagles know better than anyone that you can't be certain. Only a few teams in the league can be certain who they have at quarterback. So by moving some of that draft capital into next year, where you have a couple of big quarterbacks who are at least projected to come out now, who had great years as sophomores, and then moving even more into 2024, they give themselves an opportunity to hedge a little bit on Hurts and not have to spend it all this season and not have the ability to potentially move up next season to get the quarterback that they want if Hurts struggles this year.
The two-parter, back to the offseason signings for a second. What's your most underrated signing of the offseason? What's your most overrated signing of the offseason?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, maybe I'll just stick with the Chargers here for underrated signings. And, you know, it's not the smallest number, maybe, for Sebastian Joseph Day and Austin Johnson, who they signed for respectively $8 and $7 million a year. Of course, there's, you know, the guarantees on that are lower when you extend out the type of contracts here. But I think the way that they'll fit into the defense and the type of defense they're playing, which is generally playing that too high shell coverage there, by bringing in larger interior defensive linemen, what it does is it allows you to stop the run, which they were horrible at last season, all the way down to needing a stop against the Raiders in that final game and not being able to get it after the whole timeout controversy. But it was really a problem that they just could not stop the run. So by being able to have those players up front, it's going to allow them to play the type of defense they want to play and not have to commit as many resources when it comes to the secondary to stopping the run, and then really build around that whole defense. You combine that with Khalil Mack coming in and Joey Bosa on the outside. I just think it can be one of those plays where there's like secondary and maybe even tertiary effects for how it affects that defense beyond what that one individual player will do from different type of production metrics.
Yeah, okay. You're so good with the analytics and stuff like that. I wanted to make sure we got you on the new overtime rules. Now, in the playoffs, basically each team is guaranteed a possession in the playoffs. What do you think about it? And does it change anything from the perspective of how teams should operate in those settings, strategically speaking?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that it changes is you're going to have to, you know, you would obviously take the first possession before if you were in the playoffs. And I wouldn't expect this trend necessarily to continue, but 7 out of the 12 times, the last 12 overtimes in the playoffs, teams have gone down and scored a touchdown on that first possession to end the game. So that can't happen anymore. But what it really comes down to is whether or not teams are going to make mistakes on their choices when it comes to going for two in a lot of these different circumstances. Because I think whether you go first or second, I believe second is a little bit better if you're using kind of an optimal strategy. But what you also don't know is you don't know how well or how optimal the strategy is going to be for teams on the other side. And I think that's what makes it interesting. There's a little bit of game theory here, because we've already seen, I think it was Tom Pelissero of NFL Network sent out a message after this rule came through saying that there were some coaches who were saying they'd still want the ball first and then they would go for two. But the problem is when you're doing that, the other team has its chance, gets the ball back, and now they have that information about whether or not you made it if you're going for two. So they only have to attempt a two if you made it. And if you didn't make it, they can just kick an extra point and win the game. So it's not the best strategy. So really right now, the best strategy is if you score a touchdown, the first team scores a touchdown, they should always be going for one. And if that first team scores a touchdown and goes for one, the second team that gets the ball should always be going for two and trying to end the game right then and there if they score a touchdown, because that's basically like a 50-50 proposition to win rather than kicking the ball back to the other team and having it be a sudden death game, which is obviously not 50-50 for your team. So the interesting thing for me is, will teams play this out in the way they should? And if they do, I think going second is slightly better. But what's really great about it, in my opinion, is it's not an obvious answer, which it has been in the past.
I'm really excited to see how NFL coaches undoubtedly screw this up some way, shape, or form.
I think going for it after the first touchdown. I think going right after the first touchdown, that seems like a very coach sort of thing to do. What's always weird to me about NFL coaches is you can't get them to go for two at all when there's maybe half a quarter left, a full quarter in the third quarter, and you know that it really makes sense to go for two, they won't do it. But they love going for two at the end of the game, or they love going for two to try to avoid overtime or avoid a tie in overtime and taking more risk. So that would be kind of the unnecessary risk I could see teams doing very often, is maybe thinking that if they go for two there, they're going to effectively end the game. But of course, the other team has the chance to you know, take the ball down the field. They know they can't kick field goals. They know they can't, you know, punt the ball. So they're going to be extra aggressive and go for two themselves. So some coaches may be playing themselves out of a good situation, but we'll see. We'll see. Hopefully they're listening to people, you know, nerds like me who are telling them what to do in those circumstances.
Absolutely. Even digging into the draft for PFF, it really, your coverage has been excellent, as it always is. Give me one guy who has really impressed you so far.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to stick with quarterbacks for both of the kind of like impressed and maybe not as impressed category, just because those are guys that I've been digging into a little bit more. And I think the market for where these guys are going to go is a bit off from my perception. So I like Matt Corral a lot out of Mississippi. And I think for him, what I found is there are a few different attributes, at least going back as far as we can in our data for PFF, which goes back to 2014. There are a few different attributes that I've found that quarterbacks have been more successful than others. And one of them is how efficient they are under pressure relative to how efficient they are from a clean pocket. And so you want quarterbacks who are going to be good under pressure relative to how they've been in a clean pocket, because of the fact that the NFL is just not going to be as easy as of an experience as it's going to be for, as it was in college. So you want guys that are overperforming. That's kind of what they do now, whether it's Patrick Mahomes or Josh Allen or Justin Herbert. These guys are going to outperform in those sort of instances. And the second thing is, you want someone who's going to avoid sacks. And I think avoiding sacks is something that typically does not get brought into the discussion, because people are very concerned about, you know, different throws, different concepts. And then they, you know, if they're evaluating tape and they see someone take a sack, you can very easily pin the blame on the offensive line. But there is a quick decision-making component when it comes to sack avoidance, whether it is knowing how to move in the pocket, whether it's knowing when to scramble, whether it's knowing whether just to go ahead and throw an incompletion rather than take a sack there. And Corral has been very, very good at that, whereas guys like Malik Willis and Sam Howell have been pretty poor in the other direction. But you just don't hear about it a lot because, again, people are very concerned with how they throw the ball under particular circumstances as opposed to how they operate maybe in a quick, fast environment having to make a quick decision.
You kind of just gave us a couple here, but anybody who's expected to go high and has underwhelmed you in your research for the draft?
I mean, I don't know if he's underwhelmed me, but again, going back to quarterbacks, I just don't understand the Malik Willis thing. I mean, I understand it from the perspective of we just only care about physical traits more than anything else. But at the same time, Willis is not Josh Allen, okay? Willis is a little bit over 6 feet tall, and 219 pounds. So he's well built for a little bit over 6 feet tall, but his you know, just height and weight, it almost matches someone like Baker Mayfield, not Josh Allen. So I just don't get the comparison there. I know he's got a great arm. I know that he ran very well, but just someone who came from a small school, is on the older side, took a long time to play well, and kind of didn't really play that well as a senior. I mean, it's not even a small school. It's Liberty of all small schools, and Liberty did not perform well anytime they had to play anyone who was a top-notch team. I mean, I know his teammates weren't necessarily helping him out, but just the things that I can attribute to quarterback play when it comes to accuracy and when it comes to taking sacks, he was just really poor in those circumstances. So, of course, you know, anyone can be successful. You can always point to the outliers in that circumstance, but he just seems like someone – a year or two ago that would have been, you know, maybe he's an interesting pick at the end of round two or round three. And now we're talking about him being a top 10 pick or the second pick overall. And I'm just a little shocked by that, honestly.
How do you have, and this is, I'm just thinking of this now. I didn't prep you for this.
Sure.
How do you grade him compared to like a Jalen Hurts when Hurts came out?
I mean, he was graded a lot worse than Jalen Hurts. The thing with Jalen Hurts is, you know, he had this time at Alabama and then he went over to Oklahoma. So I think for Hurts, it was weird. There was almost this established thought on who Jalen Hurts was that discounted everything that happened in his final season at Oklahoma. Maybe just because he ran a lot and he wasn't necessarily, you know, like a Joe Burrow type of breakout. But, you know, Joe Burrow was someone who really didn't do anything until his final season. You know, Kyler Murray didn't even play except for really one season. And those guys haven't had as much of a discount to what they did. So I think people really imputed maybe the fact that he wasn't as great at Alabama and Tua looked a lot better as to him not being that great of a prospect, but he had one of the most efficient and highest and, you know, well-graded seasons that we've seen over the last 5 years, not on Joe Burrow's level, but in that kind of top tier number in his final season, you know, nowhere close to, I mean, Willis was nowhere close to that type of performance.
All right, last one I've got for you. Obviously, this is going to change quite a bit between now and then.
Right.
But right now, FanDuel has the Bills penciled in as the favorites to win it all, to win the Super Bowl next year. They're at plus 650. They're followed in order by the Bucks 7-1, Chiefs plus 950, Rams and Packers both 11-1. Then in order, Chargers, Niners, Broncos, Cowboys, Browns. That's the top 10. Kevin, if you had to pick somebody today, and I'm making you pick somebody today, who are you taking to win it all?
It's tough. I don't know if I see a ton of value there because the AFC is just so – I mean, I would like to say the Chargers, but the AFC and the AFC West is just so difficult that I don't want to necessarily pin it on that. So for that reason, I would flip over to the other conference, and I would go ahead and say the Bucks because – they have lost some pieces, but they retained most of the major players that they have there. They have Tom Brady coming back, the ageless wonder Tom Brady coming back for another season. And everyone else in that division, I mentioned how the Packers were kind of on the downside as far as how much value that they've lost with Devontae Adams and others. The Rams have lost some pieces there. And of course you have Matthew Stafford maybe going into year two. I'm not saying they'll, you know, teams will figure him out, but they probably have a better defensive strategy against him where he didn't grade nearly as well as how efficient he was. And, you know, the other major teams in the NFC, it's just not much competition there at all, especially in that NFC South. So I just think that easy runway for the Bucks trumps the fact that I believe the Bills and maybe the Chiefs are better teams, but the Bucks just have such an easy runway to potentially get to the Super Bowl.
Among NFL nerds, the real deal NFL nerds, the Chargers are going to be the team to watch this year, aren't they?
Oh my God. Well, the Chargers have been almost a joke, how they've been the darlings of NFL media for so many years now.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, you know, Brandon Staley, everyone loves him. And what he's done there with fourth downs. We just got to hope they continue to be successful there. Herbert continues to be good. But, man, like it's just a killer AFC West. I mean, right now the Raiders, you know, they trade away all this and signed a huge contract for Devontae Adams, and it just barely even moved the needle for their Super Bowl or even their division chances just because how tough it is in that division this coming up in 2022.
It's going to be a fun season, man. Thanks so much for catching us up. Kevin Cole, Pro Football Focus data scientist, an RNG fave, you're the man. Thanks for coming on.
All right, thanks.
Okay, if I'm talking in a whisper, my friends, and the birds are chirping, it can only mean one thing. It is time to talk Masters Gambling. Joining me now Cam Rogers, the host of Lock It In on the Believe Network on Twitter. He's at Mr. Rogers 99, fellow former Terp as well. Hashtag Merrill Maid. What up? Cam, are you ready for a tradition unlike any other?
Oh, I am more than ready now, like 110% ready, because we have one Tiger Woods competing at the Masters this week earlier than I could have ever projected. I am amped up. Great to be with you.
I know, man. I had to blow up the old rundown a little bit this morning because we are recording this early Tuesday afternoon, and Tiger Woods, just in the last couple hours, came out and said he plans to play in the Masters. This is pretty incredible. Real quick, just so everybody remembers what we're talking about here, Tiger was in a terrible accident a little more than a year ago outside of LA. He says doctors nearly amputated his right leg. He hasn't played competitive golf since. And, you know, injury aside, we're talking about a guy who is 46 and won his first Masters 25 years ago. 25 years. Cam, what are we expecting from Tiger, assuming that he does, in fact, play? And it looks like he will.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can answer this question for you in two separate ways. Number one, my expectations and the pundits out there. Number two, Tiger's expectations. Let's start with Tiger. He said it today. He is competing in the Masters to get a sixth green jacket. He is not here to smack it around and have a couple laughs with his buddies. No, he is here to compete for a major championship and win, not a top 20, not a top 10, not to rack up FedEx Cup points. So that's always been Tiger's MO too. Whenever he played a particular PGA Tour event, the expectation was to win, not second, etc. So that is his expectation. And major respect to Tiger Woods for believing in that 14 months out of this horrific car crash. Now, my expectations, obviously, some cold water on all of that. I think making the cut this week would be truly remarkable. Finishing inside the top 20, in my opinion, would be a successful week at the Masters for Tiger Woods. You know, it's interesting. He's playing here on a really difficult to walk golf course. So much terrain, undulations, and what have you. You thought it would have been a little bit more logical for him to come back for the Open Championship at St. Andrews, flatter golf course, et cetera, et cetera. But here he is. So the big test for him is really not his game per se, because by all accounts, it looks great by everybody out there who's watched him and played with him, but more so about him walking this golf course. And that is the key here for 72 holes.
As of Tuesday morning, FanDuel has Tiger at minus 102 to make the cut. So about even money. They've got him at minus 126 to miss the cut. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm going with him to make the cut. I think that's probably the safest bet you can make for Tiger Woods. Remember, at the Masters, we have a smaller field, 91 guys, a lot of amateurs, a lot of past champions who are not even full-time PGA Tour or professional golf members anymore. Those guys are likely to miss the cut. And so we're talking about Tiger Woods, by the way, in the sense that he has come back to Augusta after long layoffs before and played decently back in 2010. Of course, it was the 2009 car crash, the Escalade, and the PR nightmare that he had. Played zero PGA Tour golf, showed up, finished tied for fourth. Again, not injury related, but still pretty bad on the psyche for sure. And then in 2015, the back injury shows up after a long layoff and finishes T17. So I think making the cut at Augusta National is a safe bet for me. Typically, Augusta caters to that older guard on the PGA Tour, guys with a lot of experience at the Masters. Making the cut, I think that's a pretty safe bet.
Great breakdown. I really like that and your reasoning behind it. Before we get into more of who you think we should bet on, I want to talk a little bit about which types of bets you think would be good to make. For instance, we had the legendary DMV legend Joe House on the pod a little while back. House recommended betting head-to-head matchups. So for instance, this is just a random one, but you can bet Rory versus Koepka. Rory is minus 108, Koepka is minus 102 as of now. House also said to never try and bet the winner. He said, in his opinion, it's really hard to do and the odds aren't good enough. Do you agree? Are there other types of bets that you think would be good to make, Cam? And I ask this because a lot of our listeners are probably going to bet the Masters because it's the Masters. I'm going to bet the Masters because it's the Masters. However, many of us are not typical golf bettors. So what types of bets do you think would be good for somebody like me to look at?
Yeah, I agree with that logic in terms of the entire scope of the PGA Tour season. It is so hard to get an outright right but man, is it tempting when you see those odds. Now, typically that's for a 156 player field, right? You can really whittle down your player pool this week at the Masters. You can go from essentially 91 guys to, I would say, 25 to 30 guys who have a realistic shot at winning the Masters this week. So if there were to be a week to actually bet an outright, and I actually already have a card out there in terms of my outrights, I think the Masters makes a lot of sense because typically it is a chalky event. But as far as the whole scope of the PGA Tour season is concerned, I like to stay away from outrights. I like the matchups as well. Obviously, you're not making as much money doing so, but it's like betting on a game, right? One versus one, and you can find some fun plus money out of those matchup bets. That's typically what I like to do. I typically don't ride the juice like minus 167 or anything like that. I look for those advantages in the plus money department. I do like top finishing positions as well. Top 20s are my favorites. You can find some pretty good value there. Take a look at some recent form for guys who are hitting the ball well and can finish inside the top 20. I think that makes a lot of sense. Top 10s as well. You can find some value there. So yeah, there are some interesting props out there sometimes, like top American, top South African, down the line from there. I typically don't do top American because obviously, typically week in and week out, mostly the PGA Tour is made up of Americans, so you have a wider player pool. It's harder to predict, but I do like kind of going narrower, like top Scotsman, if you will, top South American, continental European, those sorts of things. You can find some value there as well. So golf is extremely volatile, extremely random. You can miss two cuts, finish top 10 the next week. It's so hard to predict, but the more you do it, the more experience you have, the better for you.
I saw you posted your Masters power rankings. Let's do your top three. I'll start with number three, work to one, and just briefly let me know why you like each of these players this week. First up, number three, you have Shane Lowry. What do you like about him, Cam?
Yeah, serious outright value here this week, to be frank with you. If the conditions turn bad, I think Shane Lowry can really thrive in that grinder type of mentality. Ranked seventh in approach over the last 24 rounds in this field. The iron game is great. Gain strokes with his putter in three straight events, seven straight top 25s in stroke play events worldwide, couple of top 30s at the Masters the last couple of years. So he's starting to figure it out. Prior to those last 2 years, not so great at the Masters. So I think that experience is really coming along. The ball striking is just elite. So I like him a lot there at number three.
Number two, Justin Thomas.
Yeah, so he's getting a lot of buzz in the golf betting community this week. He was at number one for me, and then I did some more research, and somebody else is at number one now. But JT made the switch to Jim Bones Bakai, of course, former caddy of Phil Mickelson. That matters a lot, considering Bones was on the bag for Phil's green jackets. Six top eight finishes since November for JT. Great par five scorer, elite ball striker, just consistent. Second in strokes gained, tee to green so far this year. JT makes a lot of sense this week.
Number one, the guy you are picking to win it all. Go ahead. Who is it?
A wonderful number in the outright market, too. Daniel Berger to get it done. He will win his first major championship of his fantastic career. Nine of the last 10 Masters champions had at least two top 15 finishes in the previous three events. Berger, one of those guys. Eight of the last 10 Masters winners gained at least 1.5 strokes per round from tee to green in the 3 months leading into the Masters. Berger, one of those guys. Tee to green game is great. Iron game overall. Eighth on tour in scoring average. Recent Masters resume isn't like amazing, but he was top 10 in his debut back in 2016. That tells you a lot that he can quickly learn a golf course. So Daniel Berger is my guy to get it done.
Other guys you had in your top 10. John Rahm, Will Zalatoris, Rory, DJ, Koepka, a few others in there too. Anybody else you want to hit on?
Yeah, I think we certainly have to draw our attention to Brooks Koepka, not getting talked about enough. But how about this resume at the majors? His ranks in the majors since 2016, scored a par first, birdies are better first, rounds in the 60s first, wins first. When it's a major, Brooks shows up, especially at Augusta National. Forget about the miscut. Last year, he was hurt. He could barely bend over. Now he's playing a lot better. Third at the Phoenix Open, 16th at the Honda Classic, 12th at the Valspar Championship. So he's trending nicely there. I really like Brooks Koepka this week. Matt Fitzpatrick is the ultimate dark horse for me. Improved iron game, 19th on tour. Number one in strokes gained total on the PGA Tour this season. So you could make the argument that he is the best player right now on the PGA Tour. 4 top 10s and 5 PGA Tour starts so far this year, and has a pretty steady Masters resume. Nothing amazing, but making cuts. And that tells me a lot that he's continuing to learn this golf course. So I would look for Matt Fitzpatrick as a guy to watch.
I like it, man. Nice little dark horse there. I haven't heard that one anywhere else. One more, Cam, before I let you go. I believe you've got a few additional bets that you like. Take it away. Unload on me. What do you got?
Yeah, so let's start with the outright real quick, Josh. Daniel Berger, he's my guy to get it done here this week. Rory McIlroy for a top 10. Look, I was close to betting him outright, but I think there's too much pressure on him to get this final leg of his career Grand Slam. I don't know if it'll happen here this week. The iron game is a little bit concerning for me, but top 10 in this field in strokes gained around the green, number 3 in driving distance as well. The concern with Rory, of course, as I mentioned, the iron game and his ability to start slowly and then catch fire on the weekend. So a backdoor top 10 for Rory McIlroy makes some sense for me. Russell Henley for a top 20 here this week. This guy, his ball striking has been absolutely fantastic, and I think that's going to continue here this week. 7th on tour in strokes gained tee to green over the last 50 rounds. 3rd in strokes gained approach. 11th tee to green. Has made 15 cuts in a row. So he's a steady guy for a top 20. You're not asking a lot here, Josh. So I like that play a lot. And then Corey Connors for a top 20 as well. Another guy who hits a million fairways. Tee to green game is fantastic overall. 2 top 10s at the Masters the last couple of years, really out of nowhere. And if you can find just a decent putter, all I'm asking is a top 20. I think that's in the realm of possibility here this week.
Cam, this is awesome, man. You killed this. Where can listeners find you?
Yeah, absolutely. Follow me on Twitter at Mr. Rogers 99. You can follow the Lock It In podcast with Cam Rogers wherever you get your podcasts. And check me out on Twitter as I do more and more interviews here this week. It's so fun talking to all you guys. Excited to see what Tiger Woods does.
Cam Rogers, check him out on the Lock It In pod on the Believe Network. Mr. Rogers 99 on Twitter. Cam, this was awesome. Would love to have you back for future majors if you got a few minutes to pop in. And thanks so much. Go Terps.
Go Terps, baby. Philip Merrill, let's go.
Joining me now, Politico's Jeremy B. White, who co-writes the California Playbook and covers politics in the Golden State. Jeremy, thanks so much for coming on.
Pleasure to be here.
So I reached out to you last week after you published an article I thought was really, really good. It's titled, "The Holy Grail of Gambling Could Break American Sports Betting Wide Open." So let's start there. If 33 states and DC have already passed sports betting measures, why is California the holy grail?
It's simply about size. California is America's most populous state with about 40 million people. And so if sports betting becomes legal here, you're talking about billions and billions of dollars in revenue. And, you know, the experts I spoke to who have studied sort of the national picture here made the point to me that while most people now live in one of those states that you identify that have legalized sports gambling, some of the big populous ones are still out there, Texas, Florida, and especially California. And there is a sense of sort of momentum and inevitability out there among the states that have not yet gotten it on board just because there's so much money available. But certainly if you were thinking about sort of the individual markets, state by state, and what sort of beckons as a big prize, there's no doubt that California is worth an enormous amount of money.
And among some experts, the belief, I believe, is that if California legalizes it, pretty much all the other holdouts are going to have to do it as well. Is that accurate?
That does seem to be the feeling out there. I think some of it is states that haven't legalized it, looking at those who have and saying, why are we missing out on this revenue? There's also an aspect of it, I think, where if California is able to find some sort of way to legalize it, despite all of the entrenched interests that are duking it out here, perhaps that would then show that there is a way for other states to do it, even if they have a similarly sort of contentious mix of players going for a slice.
So you just touched on this, and I know this is really hard to do in a concise manner, which you did so well in your article, but explain to me these varying interests that are currently going at it in California.
Absolutely. So historically, when it comes to betting in California, it's really been sort of a rivalry between Native American tribes who have casinos and can run various forms of gambling on their land if they have compacts, and then sort of card rooms and racetracks, non-tribal interests that can do some forms of gambling, not quite as much as the tribes. And that has been where the tension has been in California, including in early efforts to legalize sports wagering. But more recently, we have seen these big national platforms like DraftKings and FanDuel come into the state and drop $100 million for starters to try to pass a ballot initiative, as you can do in California, to let them oversee this new market. And so that has really added a new variable in there and a lot of money. For now, although the tribes do have a measure already qualified for the November ballot, a lot of the money seems like it is going to be going towards fighting these platforms and preventing them from controlling online betting, especially, which I think everyone sees as potentially way more lucrative than placing physical bets at a brick and mortar casino.
Yeah, all the experts say mobile attracts 8 to 9 times more more money bet than the brick and mortar spots. So right now we've got these two competing measures, both likely to be voted on in November by California voters, and not December. It's already been a long week here, Jeremy. You mentioned the one from the likes of FanDuel, BetMGM, DraftKings. Now you've got this other one from the tribes, and you mentioned the $100 million from the gambling companies, these big international companies, and what the tribes have kicked in about $100 million as well, correct?
And that $100 million is specifically just to fight the platforms. That's not to pass their own measure. Plenty of money going there as well. In fact, just today before we started talking, I noticed one of the tribes that backed the already qualified brick and mortar one dropped another $5 million. So there are a lot of folks out there who think that this fight could end up breaking the existing records for a ballot initiative in California. And I'm inclined to think with the amount of money that is at stake for the winner and the amount of money that's already been put in, I would not be surprised at all if this becomes the most expensive campaign in California history.
It's unbelievable. And it's one of the reasons I really wanted to have you on the podcast, because I think a lot of people live in these 33 states or DC. They already have this. They think it's kind of a done deal. But in reality, some of the biggest states, some of the biggest prizes are still going at it. And there are huge sums of money going towards this fight. And it really is a knockdown, drag out fight.
Absolutely. And, California, there are two ways you could have passed this. You could have the legislature come up with a deal and put it on the ballot, or you could just collect signatures and put it right to voters. The legislature tried to do the first way, and they couldn't get it done. There were too many competing interests who had no desire to really compromise. And so now we see the players circumventing the legislature and taking it directly to the people. And policymakers would always prefer to do it in the legislature. Among other reasons, it makes it a little easier to amend it after the fact. But I think the experience demonstrated that it was unlikely to get a deal, and that going right to voters was probably the way this was going to have to happen, I think, is what a lot of people came to believe.
Are you a gambling man, Jeremy?
I played some poker in my day.
Well, if you had to bet, you think either or both of these initiatives go through in November?
It's a great question. There was some recent statewide polling out that didn't ask about a specific one, but just said, you know, there's ideas out there to legalize sports betting. Would you do it? It was short of a majority. I think it was at something like 45%, with about a quarter of people undecided. So a lot of money is going to be spent to move those numbers between now and November. But I will also say we are on track right now to have two, maybe even three different initiatives on the ballot. And history has shown that oftentimes when voters are asked to sort of decipher multiple competing initiatives on the same topic, a lot of them just sort of throw up their hands and say, forget it, I'm not going to bother with this. So I think there's a real possibility that none of them pass, especially with the amount of money that's going to be spent to sort of knock down opponents. And in that case, you know, maybe that does create some more momentum for a deal ahead of 2024, so we don't do this all over again.
Well, that was my next and final question for you. If these don't pass, I guess, I mean, you make the good point that there could be some sort of deal, so we don't end up here. If we do end up here again and people are trying to get various initiatives on the ballot, do you think this kind of money is going to come back around one more time?
Hard to imagine it wouldn't. I mean, the big incentive for avoiding a ballot fight if these don't pass this year and we're looking at the next cycle may be to avoid having to spend hundreds of millions of dollars again. But it may well be that these players will do some back of the envelope math about what they could stand to make versus what they would have to spend to pass this and decide it's worth the investment. So I think, you know, that's a couple moves ahead of us, but I think it is totally possible that we could end up doing this again next campaign cycle.
This is really, really good. Really, really interesting stuff. My apologies, Jeremy, if you hear my one-year-old daughter crying in the background, that's as good a time as any to sign off from this. Where can listeners find you?
So you can follow me on Twitter at Jeremy B. White, and anybody who's interested in California politics, I would encourage you to subscribe to our California Political Playbook. It's free and it shows up in your inbox every weekday.
And listeners, please check out this article that that Jeremy wrote. This was really, really good. I enjoyed it. I read it a couple times, actually, to make sure I wasn't missing all the nuance that you had in there. Jeremy B. White, Politico California politics reporter, California Playbook co-writer. Great stuff, man. Appreciate you hopping on.
Thanks, Josh.
All right. There it is, ladies and gents. I enjoyed those three interviews. I hope you did, too. We'll be back next Wednesday. As always, we'll see. We might add some stuff during the week. But as of now, we have RNG First Ballot Hall of Famer Raheem Palmer booked. Raheem is going to come on to do our big NBA playoffs preview. I'm really excited about this episode. And I've already told him that we will be expecting both another edition of Rostradamus Returns as well as Storytime with Raheem to classics. Otherwise, thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing. IG, Nat Rambling and Gambling. Email ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Everybody, have a great week.